Welcome to the Flo Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:05, and that's Pacific Summer Time. And today is Friday. It's actually Friday, May 13th, and markets generally finished in negative territory on Wall Street. So, actually, probably a good day to talk about the long-term outlook for markets, and also that we're entering a period of uncertainty. And there's certainly things happening out there that are very reflective of that. First off is that Apple this week broke down to a new low. And this is still the biggest share in the world. And okay, they make 2/3 of their money from the iPhone, and mobile phone sales have been declining. So it is a bit of a totem, and it broke down yesterday, and it wasn't really able to do very much beyond hold steady in here today. So it's not particularly encouraging, despite the fact that you do have a short-term oversold condition. And today we had retail sales figures out of the US, which were more positive than expected, and economic growth from the Eurozone, which was a bit better than expected. So, but of course, expectations weren't particularly bullish to begin with. So when we have an outperformance, it's not as if we have surging sales, but rather that they're just coming in a bit better than expected. Then, when we look at various markets, then we've had this very sharp pullback in January. And that is important because we really should just go back to the discipline of the chart seminar and behavioral technical analysis from first principles, and just ask some very basic questions. And just trying to describe the market as if you were speaking to a blind person and they were unable to see the chart, so you had to describe it to them. And if you look at, for example, the Dow Jones or the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, then what would you say? You would say that the market hit an accelerated bottom in late 2008 or early 2009. Then we had an emphatic rebound. Then it moved into a volatile ranging pattern, which was a consolidation above the low. Then the market broke out again, and it had another volatile ranging pattern, one above another. And then a very similar story in 2011. And by that stage, it would appear that people started to get the message, and that one always anticipates that as a trend evolves, that it becomes progressively more consistent. And it becomes more consistent because more people are encouraged to come in and support the market. There is nothing like a bull market and profits accruing in one's account to improve one's perspective on the likely upside potential. And that's, I would say, a trait common to just about all human beings. So then people get the message. People that have got been accruing profits, they're more likely to hold on to them in the hope that things will go better. And the trend got progressively more consistent. We moved into this period of time where the consistency of the trend between about the beginning of 2012 and the end of 2015 became very consistent indeed, where the pace of the advance picked up, the size of the reactions got smaller, and the fact that the market was able to find support in the region of the 200-day moving average, that lends itself to the consistency. And then we moved into a much more volatile ranging environment from last year. We had a very large pullback in August, and that was in part because we had this blow up in the ETF sector, so people would have been tempted to rationalize. But the reality is that when you have a large pullback like that, what does it tell you? It tells you that there were stops in the market, and that at least some people were stopped out of their positions, and that is a cause for reassessment. Well, we had an emphatic rally back from the August low. Then the Fed raised interest rates in December, and the market pulled back very sharply again in January. So the people that had been surprised by the pullback in August and had been playing the market on the rebound were saying they weren't going to be caught twice. So they would have had very tight stops, and then those stops were all triggered at the beginning of January when markets started to pull back. Well, now we've had this loss of momentum and two violent pullbacks in the space of 1 year. But what does it tell us in terms of this consistency of the trend and the imbalance between supply and demand that creates uptrends? Well, we don't have the same imbalance between supply and demand now that we had between 2012 and 2015. That's very clear from the chart. That's a chart fact. That's not hypothesis. There's nothing subjective about that. So then we have to ask some simple questions. Is there any evidence of, well, is the trend still consistent? No, the trend is not still consistent. What were the consistency characteristics? Well, that it was continuing to go up, that it was finding support in the region moving average, that the reactions were relatively similar sized and relatively small compared to what had gone previously. And all of those things have now changed. Well, is there evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend ending? Well, it didn't accelerate higher, so we do not have type 1 ending. We have had massive reactions against the prevailing uptrend. That's a type 2 characteristic. And then, is there a type 3? Has it been going on for a long time? Or is this ranging time and size? Has there been a marked loss of momentum? Is the market ranging? Is it a very large range relative to what we saw previously? Well, a type 3 never starts out as a type 3, but a type 2 can certainly evolve into a type 3. And what we are presented with right now is a potential developing type 2 top formation. We've had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. The range has got all the way back up to test the high. And sometimes the range doesn't get quite that high, and sometimes the range is much smaller following one of those massive reactions against the prevailing trend. But until we see the market breaking out to new highs and holding it, then it would be very hard to argue that we haven't seen a medium-term top in the stock market and that the market has already topped out. Well, at the close today, the S&P 500 is closing out the day below 2050, and not very much below it. It's at 2047, and then additional follow-through next week would confirm resistance in the region of the 2100 area. And that would open up the door to another deeper pullback, and that would contribute to the overall rangy environment that we have. Now, then the big question, and I'm sure it must be on everyone's lips and everyone that is looking at these markets and considering, is this a short-term top, a medium-term top, or a long-term top? Well, it's not a short-term top. We already had the short-term top. That was nearly a year ago. It is a short-term top. If we see additional follow-through with the market closing below 2050 again on Monday, or taking out and moving to a new reaction low in the very short term. But is it a long-term top? And the first defense, I'm sure, that would come into people's minds is that no, it isn't, because valuations are nowhere near where they were at previous bubble peaks. Well, valuations weren't very high in 2007 either. Certainly, they weren't cheap, but we didn't have a huge overextension in terms of valuations. We did have a very large overextension in valuations in 1990, in the 1990s, 1999, where it peaked, and you had silly multiples on companies that had no earnings at all. So we don't have that environment. But what we do have is we've had an environment where there has been massive monetary intervention. And when we say that valuations are not extreme, then it is worth considering that exactly what is it that you're using to measure valuations. Fundamental analysis is not the same as technical analysis. Fundamental analysis is constantly open to conjecture. Behavioral technical analysis relies purely on facts. And I know that that is a very controversial statement to make, but considering the shenanigans that go into creating a positive perspective on earnings, and the very fact that price earnings are not price divided by earnings. It is price divided by earnings per share. So the earnings per share in its own right is a ratio. So price earnings is in fact a ratio of a ratio. And that means it's a derivative of the very basic, of really what people think of as a very basic measure of value. And we know that companies have been buying back shares with alacrity over the last 7 years. And in fact, it's over $2 trillion has been taken out in terms of share capital from this market. And of course, if you're, let's say, for example, the Power Shares Buyback Achievers ETF, a company has to buy back 5% of its overall free cash flow in order to gain access to that index. And there are well in excess of 100 companies in that index which have been buying back 5% of their free float. Well, obviously, if you're buying back 5% of your free float on an annual trailing basis, then that will certainly help to support the price. But it also helps to depress the price earnings ratio. So then when we look at valuations, I don't think it is accurate to simply look at them and say, oh, well, here's the absolute value, because it is not an absolute value. It's a relative value. And it's not just a relative value, it's a derivative value. Now, we had problems with looking at derivative values for bonds in 2007. It's because what people were doing were saying, well, credit default swaps are more liquid than bond markets, so we would be much better off looking at the CDS price for the bond rather than looking at the bonds themselves or looking at the fundamentals of the actual companies. And that opened up a great deal of risk. That was certainly an expedient way of looking at the market, but it wasn't the correct way. And my fear is that that is now what people are doing in terms of equity valuations, that we have had a transformation in terms of the quantity of money that has been bought back. This is not the first cycle where there have been a lot of share buybacks, but the quantity of debt that has been taken out in the last 7 years and the uses to which that debt have been put, which is basically to buy back shares and to retire old debt, which would be the most useful way of using it, and then to increase dividends. Well, the fact that what we're now seeing is that valuations are actually a factor of financial engineering. And then, does that tell us whether they represent true value or not, or what our value is as opposed to what we all think of as value, I think is very much open to question. And therefore, if we're looking at this market and asking ourselves, is there evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend-ending characteristics, the last defense that anyone should use is to say that valuations are not at bubble levels, because I don't believe that those are going to be reflective. And in fact, they will not be reflective until well after the fact. So they're not only are they next to near useless at the current stage, but that they're likely to be a lagging indicator, because by the time they have already gone up, well then it would be because earnings have deteriorated and the price will have already corrected. So I don't think that that's something that that one needs to really consider very much. Now, then we have to ask, well, if that's the case, what is it that is holding these stocks up? Then, obviously, earnings have been deteriorating, but earnings are still at historically very high levels. Then that is certainly helping to support prices. And the fact that interest rates are incredibly low. And we are in a deflationary environment overall. The the Eurozone and Japan are engaged in negative interest rates. And this really is an extraordinary experiment, and no one has any real clear idea of exactly how it's going to play out. But what has been very clear is that investors are not waiting around to find out. They're looking at potential safe havens. And certainly the fact that the Australian 10-year bond yield is testing its lows in here today, and it's pulled back rather sharply since the RBA cut interest rates. And it does look like then that the arbitrage between, and I think just going from memory, the Australian 10-year is yielding in excess of 2%, and German bunds are below zero. So you're getting a positive carry by picking up those bonds. And the Australian dollar might be weak, but it's not weak enough to compensate or to really offset the benefit that investors are getting from that yield. Now, the other thing, of course, that people are looking at is US Treasuries. They're still getting a positive carry there because the Fed is not talking about... they're certainly not ruling it out in the event that they get a worst possible scenario, but they're not really considering that they're going to have negative interest rates. In fact, with the divergence between a number of Fed governors, they're talking about raising rates at some point this year or early next year. And okay, maybe they're pushing it out. But there are people on the Fed decision-making panel that want to raise rates in June. And their decision on what exactly they're going to do is going to have really a very, very big impact. Because what we can see is that demand for bonds on the long end of the curve is compressing yields. And if you have the long end of the bond of the yield curve with yields coming down, and the two-year yield has been trending higher, and it's been trending higher modestly, but it is going up for the last 3 years, then you're getting a flattening yield curve. And that spread, which is regarded as the yield curve spread, is now at 99 basis points. And it was at 350 basis points 2 years ago. So we've had a fairly substantial contraction. And generally speaking, if that spread goes below zero, and I mean, I think it is important to highlight that it is at 99 basis points, and it could be another year, it could be a year and a half before it gets to zero. But if in the event that it gets below zero, then that's a lead indicator for US recessions. And usually it's a lead indicator by approximately a year, if not 18 months. So it's not an indication to go out and sell everything, but it is certainly an indication that you don't want to be chasing anything. You do not want to be piling additional money in, regardless of how positive sentiment is, but rather to be looking out for potential issues. Well, people are putting their money into government bonds because they're worried. They're worried that they can't get yield in Europe or in Japan, and they're worried about exactly how, on the one hand, what are Europe and Japan going to do if this negative interest rate policy doesn't work? And they're worried about what is the Fed going to do, since they're going in the total opposite direction, and how is it that they're going to eventually normalize interest rates? And what are they going to do with the quantity of money that they have sitting on their balance sheet? The Fed has got substantial quantities of treasuries that are going to expire in the next 18 months. And in fact, it's, I think it's $150 billion this year, and it's about $250 next year, and it's over $300 billion the year after. And so far, since the end of quantitative easing, the size of the Fed's balance sheet has remained absolutely static, which means that any bonds that mature are just being rolled forward. But if at the same time they're raising interest rates, it means that the new treasuries that they are replacing them with will have a higher coupon. And that represents an issue for the Treasury, because the debt servicing requirement will increase, and then economic growth will have to be that bit better to give the government ample funds with which to pay down this debt. So then obviously the easy thing to do would be just to decrease the size of the Fed's balance sheet in order to take some of the pressure off the Treasury and just allow the bonds to expire. But if they were to do that, then that would have an even greater influence on the bond markets, because it would withdraw supply from the market. Now, a lot of the supply is already outside the market, but then it would have this it would have an effect that would certainly increase volatility. And that's part of the reason that gold is doing that bit better in here right now, because gold can't simply be printed into existence, and gold doesn't have a yield, which, you know, for as long as anyone can remember, that has been the primary argument for not owning it. And all those fundamental analysts would say that, you can't value gold on a dividend discount model, and therefore it can't be valued, which doesn't show an awful lot of imagination. But realistically, right now, when it doesn't have a yield, then it's really looking quite attractive, particularly if you're in the Eurozone or in Japan. So then the question, and there was a question I tried to answer in today's comment of the day, asking about correlations between different markets. Why is it that gold is going up when the dollar is strong? And it isn't just that gold is going up when the dollar is strong, but it is that gold, treasuries, and the dollar are rallying at the same time, which in fact is actually more of an indication that you're getting some safe haven buying. And additionally interesting, and this would be then the arbiter of, is this safe haven buying or not, is that the yen was stronger also today. And when the yen strengthens, it's generally an indication that carry trades are being unwound. And it wasn't strong in a dynamic fashion in here today, but it was firmer. So if people are looking for safe havens, then the relative weakness that we're having on stock markets, where the S&P is looking a little tired up here at the upper side of this year-long range, then the potential for some profit-taking is increasing. And the divergence that we're seeing in the overall market, where an increasingly small number of companies are really doing very well indeed, and among those are Amazon, Facebook, and Nvidia. But then you have previous stalwarts, such as Nike or Walmart, which or Disney, which are looking considerably less consistent than they were. And when you have an increasing number of shares losing consistency and very narrow breadth in the market and an increase in single stock volatility, that's seldom good news. Then when we look at the commodity markets generally, certainly a stronger dollar is considered to be a headwind to commodity prices, because they're mostly denominated in US dollars. But that hasn't acted as an impediment to gold prices, because it has the safe haven status. But then the big arbiter is going to be oil prices. Oil is a large input cost in the production of just about all commodities. So when it was very cheap, it allowed substantially more marginal production to exist. And since it has rallied, and rallied impressively, then that acted as an inhibitor to marginal supply being brought to market. And then what happens with oil is likely to have a knock-on effect for the rest of the commodity sector, and perhaps a more important knock-on effect than the relative value of the dollar. And part of the reason for that is because Yes, we've had a pullback in the dollar, but the dollar was very weak for a long time, and it's had an emphatic breakout over the last 18 months. And that would be very much in line when you look at the relative strength of the US economy, the fact that it was the first to go into a recession, and it is the first to recover, and that it has these natural advantages in terms of its energy and the incubator for high technology that the entire economy represents, there are natural advantages that would mean that the economy is doing better. And if the economy is doing better, then the currency should do better. So there are reasonable reasons why the dollar should be firm. And when you have negative interest rates in major other economies, then it's hard to imagine why the dollar would stay down for long. Then we have to look at the commodities cycle. And when you look at it from the long-term perspective, then commodities generally don't do particularly well in the middle of the economic cycle. But they do bottom in the latter stages of an economic expansion, because growth is starting to pick up, but interest rates haven't really gone up enough yet to inhibit economic expansion. And that means that demand for commodities improves. So the continuous commodity index halved between 2011 and 2015. And we've had a short covering rally, and we have seen the index break back above the trend mean. And yes, there are reasons to worry if we get a very strong rally in the dollar, or we get a big pullback in oil prices, then that would pull back the commodity prices for sure. The mania that, or I should say the manias that seem to assail the Chinese market with just surprising regularity has acted as an impediment to the continued advance in iron ore prices. And then, you know, they've started to increase margins in the commodity markets to try and stop people from speculating with prices that really do have widespread economic impacts. And interesting that despite all this volatility, iron ore prices are now back in the region of the moving average and have held in this area for most of the week. And it really is at this point that if this is the real deal, then this is around the point where you'd anticipate that prices begin to find support. Well, then, because commodity prices pulled back so much, then they're less likely to be heavily influenced by other factors rather than their individual fundamentals. So the interrelationships between the dollar and the commodities, I think, are probably less likely to be an influence in the sort of the medium-term outlook for commodities, although, of course, you are going to have short-term considerations. And if we look around the world, then yes, there are certainly advantages that the US has, but Europe is muddling along with this attempt to squeeze blood out of a stone in terms of trying to get countries that really don't have the capacity to pay back debts that were run up. And there isn't, I think, a great deal to be gained by allocating blame to anybody, and yet that is certainly what has been done, rather than saying that we created an environment where monetary conditions or where credit conditions were incredibly loose, and that there is a cause and effect, that if credit conditions are very loose, then people will become over-leveraged, and just saying that was just a natural thing to happen, but rather that it was the borrower's own fault for not having more discipline, which is a pretty ridiculous argument when that is always the case, that if there is more, if there is access to credit, then people will get over-leveraged. And it really does bear in, bear thinking that if it is a cause and effect, then we have gone through an extraordinary period of time where we have extraordinarily low yields, low borrowing costs, ample liquidity, and that it is absolutely inevitable that somebody has become over-leveraged and is going to be caught. In Warren Buffett's terms, you don't know who's been swimming naked until the tide goes out. And I suspect that there are going to be a number of sectors, particularly in high yield and in the covenant light sector, where it's going to look like a nudist beach when interest rates begin to go up. Then when you think about that, that the bond markets do represent perhaps the clearest danger to a medium-term bullish way of thinking. Now, we've been through two crashes in the last 15 years, and then the bond markets represent some where there really are problems, and we are going to get additional bankruptcies. There are going to be issues that are going to crop up, and that is certainly going to come to light over the next few years. So that's why it really is worth monitoring that that yield curve spread. And it's been our view for a number of years that there are very good reasons to be of the opinion that we are at the beginning of a secular bull market, that technological innovation is improving rapidly, and that really is creating the potential for massive productivity growth. Then the evolution of the global middle class, and the fact that in high population countries, what we're increasingly seeing is that democracies are voting for improving governance. And we've seen that in India over the last few years. We've seen it in Indonesia. And just this week, we saw it in the Philippines. And in especially when you look around the world or you open the newspaper and you see where the trouble spots are, you can trace it back directly to a lack of governance or to failed governance or to, and that's particularly the case in the Middle East. And Saudi Arabia is embarking on what could potentially be a radical transformation. And one has to just wish them the very best of luck. And yet it is a really an incredible challenge they face in trying to modernize and to reform that economy. But the big one is China. And certainly what we've seen over the last few weeks have been just an increasing tightening of the social conditions. And one has to ask the question, why now? And the reason, well, there are two ways of thinking about it. Is one that, is it that they're losing control in terms of social cohesion, or is it that they're tightening control because they're getting ready to push through an additional raft of reforms? And the next raft of reforms will almost certainly attempt to tackle the massive overcapacity that we have in China in terms of the infrastructure and material sectors, especially cement and coal, so and steel production. So you know, we get these statistics where, you know, China has got more spare steel capacity than the entire steel sectors of Japan, Taiwan, and Korea put together. And you know, so there is most definitely a non-performing loans a problem. There is a problem with overcapacity, but you know, the problem that they have is that overcapacity is employing millions of people. And then are they clamping down on social freedoms because they're getting ready to fire a couple of million people, and they want to hold on to power through what is potentially going to be a very violent period of reform. And we won't know until it happens. But in the meantime, China represents a risk. And nothing says that to us more than the fact that the renminbi is depreciating, that the size of the PBOC's foreign currency reserves has contracted by several hundred billion dollars in just the last 6 months, and the renminbi hasn't devalued much relative to how much it had appreciated previously, but the trend is clear, and they have shown that they're willing to use the currency as a policy tool previously, and there's absolutely no reason to suspect that that's not what they're going to do in future. When we look at it, though, and yes, China represents a threat in the short term because they have to introduce these reforms, and China is no longer a backwater, but it's a major global economy. But if they do, in fact, introduce these reforms, that then the medium-term bullish outlook would be relatively assured, because it would really help to support the middle class. And then when you take a long-term view, the rise of the global middle class would be increasingly assured, and therefore demand for just about everything would improve. And energy prices are likely to remain low for a considerable period. There is ample supply of fossil fuels, and there is an increasing trend towards renewables and the efficiency of renewables, and the efficiency of renewables in tandem with improving battery technology represent the next important move in energy prices. Certainly we've been talking about the unconventional oil and gas and shale oil and gas or tight oil and gas being game changers for the energy sector, and that's fully priced in right now. And we know the effect that that has, and we have a template for what we can expect from oil prices in natural gas, because when prices go up, unconventional supply, which can be brought on in a very quick period of time, becomes economic, so the drilling starts or the well completions begin, and then supply increases and prices come back down. So that's what we can expect from oil prices. And then with Tesla taking 500,000 orders for their mid-priced or cheaper car, then that represents a game changer too. And I was kind of curious, but I've seen that certainly a number. I just was curious, so I said, well, how many people think agree with me? And the way to look at that is I went to a business brokerage website, and I looked for filling stations for sale. And there are a lot of filling stations for sale, because you just don't need them. If you've got an electric car, you fill up at home. And it's that kind of change, that every new electric vehicle on the road is just one more that doesn't need gasoline at all. And then that means that the demand growth profile that has been relatively assured for oil prices is unlikely to be reliable in future. And that's going to be something that is completely different. So we could be in a volatile, rangy environment for oil prices for decades. And, you know, it really means that one really has to consider that this is a much more difficult environment, and that the companies that survive are going to be the ones that really concentrate on the chemicals business rather than the transportation fuels business, would be my hunch, at least. But the most important factor is that when you get oil prices going up, that every $10 move shaves about 0.1% off GDP growth. And oil prices have fallen from $140 back to $40. So that should be adding 1%, and actually I might be quoting that wrong, it might be 0.2%, but the message is very much the same, that lower oil prices are a tailwind for economic growth. Then, if we have lower oil prices and we have a recovering middle class and we have technological innovation, and that's particularly coming through in biotechnology and in healthcare, where people are not only living longer, but living longer, healthier lives and are more productive, then those are the conditions that really do help to support a secular bull market. And that bull market could last another 10 years. It could last another 15 years. But then those are long-term considerations. And the short-term considerations are, how are we going to get out from under this massive pile of debt? And how are monetary conditions going to be normalized? And in the short term, the chances of stocks breaking out to new highs en masse is looking considerably less likely than getting some additional consolidation. And in the event that prices break down from these ranges, then valuations would improve. And then we have to get out from a reliance on share buybacks. And I think that really is something that has to be watched. But then from an investor's perspective, this isn't the time to be chasing. In fact, from a trader's perspective, it's not the time to be chasing either, but rather to wait for pullbacks, to find the things that you like at reasonable prices, and reasonable relative to their trends rather than their valuation, unless you really are a forensic accountant. And I think with that, I will leave for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.